Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the folks from Earth Care International, and we're also going to be speaking to Jose Antonio Orozco, who's written a book about Cesar Chavez. Right now, I'd like to welcome Natasha Schull. She's a cultural anthropologist, a documentary filmmaker, faculty member at Massachusetts Institute of Technology's program in Science, Technology, and Society. She's the author of the book Machine Life, Control, and Compulsion in Las Vegas. And she's a summer fellow at the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
It's good to have you back. We talked last year, I think, about your book, which had yet to come out. You are an anthropologist who works on this phenomenon of gambling, and particularly compulsive gambling.
Exactly. I've been looking at this subject for almost 15 years now. It started as an undergraduate thesis way back when in Las Vegas, right with the boom of gambling as family entertainment. So that's where it started for me.
And it's gone on from there. I mean, one of the things that is so amazing about gambling is that it used to be kind of a social thing where people would sit around at a table, you know, at home with nickels and dimes or in a casino with whatever, chips or whatever, but it was a social phenomenon. That's mm-hmm. less and less the case.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got so much media hype around live poker in film, and it's being broadcast on the sports network, etc. But if you actually look at the numbers, it's only 3% of gaming revenue that's generated by games like live poker. Really, the vast majority, the lion's share of revenue is coming from machine gambling. So I'd say about 75%. And if you go to areas where local residents are playing, they highly prefer machines. And there you've got almost 90% of revenue from these properties coming from machine gambling. So that's what I chose to look at. This has really been a phenomenon since the 1980s, accelerating to the present day.
And what's so preferable about machines?
Well, it's really a different kind of gambling. I've been this past year, and we'll continue to do so in the coming months, I've been testifying in front of different legislatures who are considering this. And what I'm always struck by the fact that people talk about gambling as if it's one thing, and they talk about compulsive gambling as if it's the same sort of activity, you know, whatever form it's taking, whether you're playing cards, whether you're shooting craps, whether you're at the machines, it's really different beasts. And what's so different about it, the overarching difference, is that you're playing alone by yourself with a machine. There are no people to interrupt you. There are no other people who will change the sort of moderate the pace of the game, the flow of the game. It's really you determining the rhythm and the pace, the speed in front of a machine. So you can really zone out, and that's the word that the gamblers I talk to use.
And they like it.
Well, like is a difficult kind of word. They're definitely drawn to it, let's say. They're drawn to the escape that they find these machines give them. It's really compelling. I guess you could say they like it, but if it becomes too compelling and they start to feel stuck there, like changes to more of a need, and that's where you have the compulsion coming in.
And the machines are designed to really foster that compulsion and that need.
They are. I mean, that's it's a difficult thing. Journalists in particular this past year have been trying to get me to say that these machines are designed to create addicts or to create compulsion. I actually don't think they're designed to do that. They're designed to increase the bottom line. They're designed to make money. And an effect of that is that they end up catering to the sort of play that sort of escape play that gamblers want, and you have a resulting situation where you've got machines that are more addicting. I'm always careful to say, I've met a lot of these designers. A lot of my research is with the designers themselves, in their laboratories, at their gaming trade shows, and a lot of them are really nice guys, and they really honestly don't think of their work. They think of it more part of the entertainment business, that they're providing entertainment to consumers, and that consumers have right to their entertainment, and that there's just a sort of small bunch of people who are vulnerable to the addiction. So they really don't connect. They actively attempt to disconnect the sorts of design maneuvers that they program into these machines with addiction.
Are any of them addicted to their own machines?
Well, that was the most fascinating part of the research for me, is that when I finally realized, you know, this project had many, it's gone on for a long time, has many stages, and at a certain point I realized I can't just talk to gamblers about their experience with the machines. I need to go and talk to the people designing the machines, start really getting in and understanding how does a random number generator work? What are these algorithms going on inside the machines? How do they pick the lights, the sounds? And that was really illuminating. And what I didn't expect is just your point that there are actually some designers who themselves have experienced this same kind of zone. I don't know that I'd describe them as gambling addicts. I'm sure they're out there. But there would always be a sort of a point toward the end of our interview when they'd say, you know, it's really funny. Even though I design these machines and I understand all of the math inside these machines, I too sometimes find myself just kind of playing not really to win, just playing to play. And I know what that zone is. So they get it. And that's precisely the point of my work, is that this is a very huge, this idea of a zone where you get absorbed in an activity and sort of stuck there and lose sense of time and space is actually a very human phenomenon. And, you know, we're all, I think, vulnerable to it under the right circumstances. And it can sometimes be really creative.
Well, and it strikes me when you say that it's probably something that's missing from American mainstream culture as something that might be built into other cultures that have trance dances or other types of activity where you go into a trance. Here we have to use a machine.
Right. Certainly as an anthropologist, I could make the argument with the extensive reading I've done in more traditional forms of anthropology that what these machines are catering to is a human tendency to want to be absorbed in a sort of trance-like kind of state. And those, I think it's the same psychophysiological state, and it's a big jargony word, but it's the same sort of psychological and physiological state as people might experience if they're dancing, or some rock climbers talk about going into the zone, or people in trance or other kind of ritual states.
And there's
the
actual brain chemicals.
The difference is the machinery. Yeah, there is actual brain chemistry that's modulating this experience, absolutely. I think the difference is, what is the medium of the zone? What is the machinery of the zone in the case of my project? And how is the machinery designed to actually channel the zone in a certain direction? And there's something very different, just to take the example of rock climbing again, between being out in the open on a mountain climbing a rock or being at the gym on a treadmill where you're being channeled in one direction. So the machines, you can kind of think about them like that. It's not a it's not a sort of free-for-all game that you can improvise as you get into the zone. The machine that's responding to you has been programmed to anticipate your responses. It's a very tight feedback loop. That's how I think about it.
And meanwhile, it's extracting money out of your wallet or credit card.
Exactly.
And you're not getting any exercise or having a common experience
exactly.
with other people.
I mean, there's certainly a large overlap in the goals of gamblers, which are to get into the zone, and the gaming industry talks about this as time on device, that's the aim of the players, is to achieve maximum time on device. And that overlaps with the industry's aim, which is to extract maximum revenue. And they have a kind of creepy-sounding word for it, or phrase, which is playing to extinction. And what that means, you know, it doesn't mean they're trying to kill us off, but it does mean they're trying to deplete our funds. It's a psychological, technical term that people can sometimes misinterpret. So to my ears, it's not quite so sinister. But playing to extinction, time on device, sort of overlapping aims. But the gambler really wants to stay in the zone. The industry wants to extract the revenue until the funds are depleted.
And so you, as an anthropologist, are studying this, and I suppose New Mexico is a good place to do that.
New Mexico is a good place to do that. You've got a lot of casinos, as everyone listening to the show knows, and you've also got a situation where these casinos are not primarily getting their revenue from tourists. They're primarily getting their revenue from New Mexicans, from locals, and this is a well-known fact, is that locals prefer machines, and locals are more likely to be what's called repeat gamblers. So they're not kind of coming in with their friends, putting a couple quarters in the machine. They're more likely to return to really, in the industry, they're known as a mature market, a sophisticated market, a market of repeat players.
Amazing. Is there any way to measure how much money is diverted into gambling and what it's diverted away from?
You know, measurements like that are really complicated, difficult to make, and you can sort of statisticians come in and demographers, and they can make arguments in one direction or another. So a lot more of that kind of research gets funded in Canada, actually, and there's some surprising and frightening studies showing that if you look at the repeat gamblers who are going regularly to the casinos, they are actually contributing a large degree of that revenue. It becomes even more disproportionate when you look at the repeat players. As to where the money's not going, you know, that really depends on the context. And in the context of Native American gaming, I mean, it's I have a colleague of mine, another anthropologist, who's just written a book. She studied with the Seminole tribe in Florida, and she actually comes out with a pretty positive analysis of what that revenue has done for maintaining traditional languages, et cetera, education, other programs. So it's certainly hard to criticize when you're looking at it that way. But I think increasingly, as this is being, you know, just everywhere, this gambling is being turned to as a source of revenue, people are realizing that it comes with problems.
Now, what are the attempts to change the laws all about these days?
Well, the attempts, if you're referring to the legislation, I mean, this is where, in places where they're considering bringing in casinos, and so it has to pass legislature.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, on the pro side, it's always, this would be an incredible boost for our economy, it would provide jobs. People who are pro gaming are usually able to get a lot of unions on board just because of the job factor. Although often then the unions turn the other way once it starts because they realize that the problems that come with it. There are definite studies showing that employees in the gaming industry have a much higher rate of compulsive gambling because they're just around it more, they're exposed to it more, and for whatever reason.
So the unions are in favor of it until it happens, and then they say, "Oh my goodness, what have we done?"
That can happen. Yes.
Good heavens. So. What are you actually doing in New Mexico right now?
Here in New Mexico this summer, this is a project that actually occurred to me as I was going around giving testimony. I was in Massachusetts giving testimony, and again, I was struck, people don't really have a sense of who these compulsive gamblers are. It's like this big, people have this stereotype that these are the real lowlifes, the degenerates, or maybe it's the old blue hairs, you know, the old ladies sitting at the machines. In fact, it's just cuts across all of those categories. So in my experience testifying, I saw that the legislatures and, to a large extent, the general public, especially in areas that don't yet have gambling, are really quite ignorant about who are these gamblers are. Who is a compulsive gambler? You know, people have this idea that it's a sort of low-life, degenerate subculture, or blue-haired old ladies in Las Vegas, this kind of thing. In fact, if you look at who's playing the machines, it cuts across all of these kind of stereotypes. Cuts across class, race, sex, etc. And so the goal of this project is to bring gamblers' own words and voices to the public, along with their images. So I was using New Mexico as a kind of pilot site to gather a set of images and a set of narratives of gamblers, again, in their own words, that I would compile and use this to get money to do a study, a book-length project across the country. And then I would imagine this book could be used. The United Farm Workers did something similar, where they could sort of discuss their cause, portray, here are farm families, here are farm workers, here they are in their habitat, here are their words, here are their stories, and a portion of the revenue from the book could be then diverted to the cause. So my idea was that as gambling continues to come up, you know, in different states across the country who are looking to make revenue, and they're actually considering, the legislatures and the public is considering inviting these kind of machine gambling into their towns, into their cities, that they could have a book to say, wow, look at all of these people. Here they are on the page. Here are their faces. Here are their hands. Here are their words. And really get a sense of who this affects.
Now, are you working with a photographer? Are you photographing yourself?
I'm here working with a photographer, and I'm doing the interviews. And it's anonymous in terms of names, because it's really more about the human stories rather than identifying particular particular people, and I photographed a couple of people who didn't want their faces shown, so I took pictures of their hands, silhouettes, etc. Others are quite happy to kind of be on the record and have their face photographed.
Are you still looking for people?
I am still looking for people, and it would be great if anyone listening to this show was interested in participating about their experiences with these machines. And these don't have to necessarily be people who define themselves as compulsive gamblers. I want a whole range of people. Basically, the book would be talking about how does this technology, how does this machine gambling technology change our experience of the gambling scene and our daily life, actually.
So if there are people who, for example, you know, once a month go and blow $75 or something like that, that's a non-compulsive, non-addicted gambler.
Right, unless they felt somehow that it was compulsive. But in my book, that would be a non-compulsive gambler. But still, I've talked to these people, and they have very interesting kind of insights about what these machines do for them. I mean, it's amazing when you start talking to people and ask them questions like, how do these machines make you feel when you're gambling? Do you think of them as a sort of the machine, as its own kind of person? Do you think of it just as a piece of machinery? What sorts do you have excitement at the machine? Do you zone out at the machine? Right. And you realize that people are having very rich kind of encounters and experiences in front of these machines. And that, to me as a cultural anthropologist, that really illuminates the human side of this whole story about gambling, machine gambling, compulsive gambling. I would like to bring that story to the public and sort of show this. We started out saying this is not a social form of gambling. It's quite asocial and isolating. And because of that, it's a sort of hidden community. It's not, it doesn't
right.
have, it hasn't gained the sort of positive reputation of something like AA and the Alcoholics Anonymous movement.
But there are Gamblers Anonymous.
Absolutely, and that's where I've been going to meet some of the people I've been talking to and photographing. But I'd like to sort of bring together this, what I think of as this kind of hidden community, and show the range, the diversity of people. You know, when I was in Las Vegas, one morning I would be in a trailer park talking to a single mother with four kids, and she
blew
the lunch money or the milk money. And later that day, I'd be over in a rich suburb of Summerlin talking to a doctor's wife whose hands were covered with jewelry, and she was blowing all the family savings. Yet they were using those two very different people on the face of it were using very similar words to describe their encounters and experiences with the machine. So to me, you've got this, I almost think about it, the machines as a kind of homogenizing force. They're homogenizing a shared experience between
right.
very diverse people. So that's the goal of this project. And I would love to have more New Mexican faces and words in this first pilot phase of this book project.
Natasha Schill, how can people reach you if they want to get involved in this?
I have a number set up. It's the number of my photographer, and it's 917.
Area code 917.
907.
Mm-hmm.
0097.
And if anybody missed that number and they would like to call, you can listen to the podcast always at santafe.radiocafe.org, or you can leave a message for me at 428-1528. Natasha Schill is a cultural anthropologist and documentary filmmaker, and she teaches at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, is the author of the book Machine Life, Control and Compulsion in Las Vegas, and she's here at the School for Advanced Research this summer. Amazing work. Is it depressing for you doing this year after year?
You know, it definitely has depressing aspects, but one can find certain redemptive threads, and especially talking to these people, they have so much insight. When you actually meet and speak with people who get labeled compulsive gamblers, you realize they're not dupes. They know what's going on. They have a great deal of insight into this problem, and they are usually happy to share that. And the idea that they could expand knowledge, people who haven't yet encountered these machines. And to me, that's really hopeful.
Natasha, thank you so much for being with us
thank
on the
you.
Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
And let me mention one more thing. I'll be here in town until the end of the month. If someone's interested and those dates don't work, I'll probably be coming back in the future, so don't hesitate to call if those dates don't work. But I'm looking for people before I leave at the end of this month,
so
July.
So throughout the month of July would
exactly.
be good. Okay, excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to you. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Taylor Selby. He is the Executive Director of EarthCare International, and Bianca Soposi-Belknap is here, and Mercedes Downing, who are also with this wonderful organization. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So, Taylor, let's start with you. What is EarthCare International?
EarthCare International is a nonprofit. We're located here in Santa Fe. We've been doing great work in the community for 6 years now. And our mission is to educate and empower youth to create a thriving, just, and sustainable world.
And unlike many environmental organizations, youth are not only involved in terms of educational programs. You guys, you too, are very much part of the daily operations of the organization.
Yeah, we are. But actually, Bianca is the coordinator for Youth Allies. So she's not much older than me, but a little older than me.
It's all relative, right?
Yeah. But actually, she's the coordinator for Youth Allies, and that's where people my age, well, actually, I'm the youngest, so people above my age.
Are you in high school? College?
I'm going to be in high school.
You're going to be in high school?
Yeah, I would be a freshman.
Oh, okay. I don't have the slightest idea by looking at people how old they are. And it's radio, so
yeah.
We can't tell anyway.
I'm old. I'm 37.
Good heavens.
Yeah, I know. I'm ancient.
So we have young people who serve on our staff, and then also young people who serve on our board, and Mercedes is a board member, and so she's actually Taylor's boss.
Yep. It's a nice switch, isn't it?
Interesting way that works.
Well, with the way we look at sustainability is it's also social justice as well, and it's also a democratic process, so we think that the young people that we serve should have a say in what we do. So that's why we put them on the board. So we actually have 5 youth that sit on our board of directors.
So what is actually the Youth Allies program?
The Youth Allies program is a group of very diverse youth, and we all get together and we learn about sustainability and the ecosystems and the environment and just all kinds of stuff like that. And we did stuff like water testing, but before we got to like the hands-on stuff, they taught us. So that we would know what's going on. We wouldn't like just be out there being weird, like not having an idea what we're doing. Because if we don't understand why we need to test the water, then it's kind of stupid if we test it.
So, for example, let's stay with that. What did you find when you tested the water? What water did you test?
We tested the water in the Santa Fe River, right?
Uh-huh. We went up to the reservoir, and actually what we did is we worked with another organization, which we also like to do, make our programming as collaborative as possible. So we worked with River Source, and we went up to the reservoir, and we tested the water there, and then we compared the results to some testing that they'd done with another group below the water treatment plant and saw what the difference was and so kind of what the impact in Santa Fe is. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the work that we do we try to make it so that we're not only doing something like that, which we'd call, you know, service learning, but also that extends beyond an individual isolated event where people are engaging with the community to actually moving into action. And so from the young people's work around water this year, they decided that they wanted to work on community gardens and stuff like that to try to create other ways of doing things and create a more sustainable food system here, and also then looking at how water interfaces in terms of our food system and how we're using water for things like development and not for agriculture. And so trying to tie, you know, simple sort of field trips or community service or service learning activities into larger projects where the young people are really kind of determining what they're interested in and then trying to make real concrete changes in the community. So they installed a garden at EarthCare and then different students did different work. Mercedes been on the radio a bunch this year. But the idea is to not only have the youth experience things that kind of transform their consciousness, but then also to have them go and interface with the community, do community education themselves, and also contribute something concrete to the community.
So, I mean, what could come of this is the next generation having really a sustainable culture in a way that we barely pay lip, we pay lip service to it, but aren't actually doing it. You're talking about having a consciousness that permeates throughout people who are in high school now.
Yeah, it's more like, it's not just being aware of what's going on, but it's like making a change. Because you can talk about something all you want to, but that's not going to change it. Like, you can whine about how, oh, blah, 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 the world's polluted, blah, blah, blah. But if all you're doing is whining, then you're not helping anybody. You have to, like, go out there and do something, and that's what we do at Earth Care and in Youth Allies.
So, Earth Care, it's, how long did you say you've been around?
We've been here for 6 years.
6 years. So, eventually you will get to the point where the youth who are in your programs graduate into the sort of working world and come back, and you've got generations of people doing this.
Yeah, in fact, one of our most recent hire that we have, let's see, Angela's second most recent hire, was actually one of the first teenagers that we worked with when we came in here to Santa Fe. So we worked with her on a really beautiful organic teen-run garden, and then she went off and got her degree in environmental studies and then came back, and now she's working for us. So
It's already happening.
It's already happening, yeah. And the youth are already on the board of directors, and it's very much youth participated and youth led as well. So.
And can I add to that too, that one of the purposes of the Youth Allies program in particular is to make sure that that next generation of leaders that return to the community and really are equipped with the skills that they need and the knowledge that they need to make a positive future for our community, that next generation of leaders is really representative of the diversity of our community. So that's why we pull youth really intentionally from the Native, Hispanic, immigrant, and Anglo community, and try to teach them how to work together cross-culturally and then how to address social and environmental issues so that they can go on to college and learn more about what they're really passionate about and then come home and become, you know, the next city councilors, the next mayor, but that those folks are really representing the very diverse communities that we have here in New Mexico.
How are some of those leadership skills brought back to the schools that these young people are going to?
Well, because some of us, I know at my school, you know, I've been doing work with Youth Allies, so I did want to do sustainability in my school. So for a lot of my projects or things that I'd have to present to a large group of people or to the grades or things like that, you know, it'd be around the environment and sustainability. And a lot of people are doing that now, too, because they're doing extra projects on it. And people are starting to change the school system, or they're trying to, based on sustainability and what they've been learning at EarthCare, or what they find is important.
Now, when you say change the school system, there's two things that come to mind. One is what's taught, and the other is how the infrastructure of the schools actually work, like their own water system and their own grounds and so on.
It would be something along those lines.
Yeah, one of the people that we're working with is Bianca Madrid. She's actually going to be coming on staff starting in August, and she's a Youth Allies person. She's been working with us for 2 years, learning with us. And what she wound up doing this last year is working with a partnership with Somos Pueblos Unidos and creating Know Your Rights for youth. And so she was actually going back to the schools themselves and teaching like peer-to-peer her students, or not students, I'm sorry, her peers how to know your rights, so that if, you know, there was a lot of raids that were happening,
right,
and, you know, just knowing how to protect yourselves and how to know what authorities can do and can't do, because a lot of youth were stopped going to school.
I heard her speak the other day at one of your events, and she said teaching young people what to do if they come home and their parents have been taken away.
Yeah, and that's happening. So no matter what people's view are on immigrations and illegal immigrant populations being here, I mean, that is something that's really personal. So, and it's something that was keeping youth from going to school as well, as they're being afraid of being taken, going to school and then removed from their family, or coming home and having their family gone as well. So she really took that project on. And because when we look at sustainability, like I said, we look at it from a social justice, environmental, cultural perspective, economic perspective. Our organization teaches economics classes, we teach government classes, we teach environmental science classes in schools. So we really look at it as holistically as we can, because when we think about sustainability, it's like our ability to sustain what we want, right?
Now, the organization is called Earth Care International. You're based here in Santa Fe. What's the international piece?
Well, right now it's that we look globally. So we're working locally here in this community, and we're looking globally, internationally. In the future, what we're working towards is to be able to be a model that can be used in other communities as well. So right now in Brasilia, they're looking at how to use. We had a gentleman that came out here for a couple of weeks to learn about earth care and exactly what we're doing to see how what is transferable to be over there in Brasilia, in Brazil. So we hope that there'll be earth care Santa Fe, there'll also be an earth care Albuquerque, and there'll be an earth care Denver, and an earth care Los Angeles, and an earth care all over the place that'll be networked together. It'll all be locally based. So that's our plan with it.
And you can share the knowledge across all these different cities.
Exactly. It's not like it's a cookie cutter because even in Albuquerque it'd be different than it would be in Santa Fe.
Yeah, the water problems here are going to be different than in Arkansas.
You bet.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to know more about earth care and get involved?
Easiest way is to go to our website, which is earthcare.org. Easy to remember. Or they can call our office, 983-6896. Yep.
Anything that you want to add before we go?
Well, I want to add that, you know, doing earth care and doing Youth Allies opened me up to, like, a lot of stuff. So, like Bianca said, our program doesn't, like, work with just youth and do just earth care. We get incorporated with other organizations as well. And so I did work with other organizations too. And so that's kind of why this is, like, one of the better programs in Santa Fe. Because, you know, they don't, like, stick to one certain little group or little clique. They kind of, like, spread out. And they mesh with a lot of different groups so that the youth aren't learning just environmental stuff and things along those lines, but they're also learning social justice and what's going on in the world right now, and they're learning about the economy, like the Living Wage Network. We did work with them way in the beginning, though.
Yeah.
But still, you know, some of us carried through with that. And we went to living wage things, and we went to the city council meetings, and this organization just, like, really inspires people.
Well, it is certainly inspiring to have all of you on the air. Mercedes Downing, Bianca Saposi-Belknap, and Taylor Selby of Earth Care International on the web at earthcare.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Jose Antonio Orozco. He is the author of the book Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence, published by the University of New Mexico Press, and he will be at Garcia Street Books here in Santa Fe tonight from 5 to 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to be here.
Give us a little background about Cesar Chavez. He was born in Arizona in 1927. How did he come to be the great labor organizer and activist we know about?
Well, his family were farm workers. They lost their home, like many Americans did, during the Great Depression in the 1920s, and they had to become farm workers, and they made their way into California in the 30s and worked as farm workers all up and down the California coast. And eventually they settled in the Central Valley area, and for many, many years, Cesar Chavez worked in the farms, picking crops, and just learned the difficulties of farm worker life there for many, many years. And then he went off to the military during World War II, and he came back and was working again in the fields, and decided that he got involved with various kinds of political organizations, and decided that it was necessary to try to alleviate the difficulty and the suffering of farm workers who were so exploited and were taken advantage of California agribusiness, and so decided that needed to start a union for farm workers. And the interesting thing about farm workers, agricultural labor in general, is that it was always one of these sectors of workers that were never protected by federal labor law, and so they were always the most vulnerable workers in the United States, and were never able to organize very effectively. And so he decided to take this on, and of course, as history shows, he went on to develop the United Farm Workers, one of the most effective labor organizations representing this very vulnerable population that feeds almost every American in the world, in the United States and in the world today.
You write about Cesar Chavez as a political thinker along with Gandhi and Martin Luther King, but he isn't usually considered that way. Why not?
Well, this is the interesting thing, and this is partly why I decided to write the book, is I teach peace and justice studies at Oregon State University, and whenever people talk about the philosophy of nonviolence, there's always these figures that are thrown around, like Thoreau and Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and these are always the names that are associated with the thinking and the theory of nonviolence. And Cesar Chavez is always brought up as an example of someone who was an activist, someone who was working and organizing people, but never someone who contributed to the theory of nonviolence, about what nonviolence means and what are the strengths that people gain from becoming nonviolent and what pacifism is about. And so what I was interested in was trying to find what were his thoughts, what were the ways in which he envisioned nonviolence as a source of power for ordinary people. And what I found by reading his speeches and some of his writings was that he had some very, very unique thoughts about how ordinary people develop power and organizing in their communities can make great changes in the quality of their life. And I saw that some of this stuff was very, very different than the kinds of things that Gandhi was talking about with his nonviolent campaigns in India. And in some senses, I found that it was even more relevant, and I think in some sense more relevant today than some of the things that Martin Luther King was talking about during the Civil Rights Movement with the use of nonviolent tactics then. So what I started to investigate was how exactly could we look at Cesar Chavez as a philosopher of nonviolence, someone who could help us understand solutions to our political problems today and our social problems, confronting violence and militarism and poverty through the philosophy of pacifism and nonviolence. And I found a rich resource in some of his thinking. And so I think that he's an underappreciated, what I call a community intellectual, an underappreciated community intellectual, someone who can help us understand the kinds of problems that the United States faces.
You said something very interesting. I mean, he has a philosophy of nonviolence, but there is another kind of power. How would you describe the nature of power in Cesar Chavez's view of nonviolent power?
Well, I think that this is something that actually he shares with lots of other philosophers of nonviolence, is that many people think that to be a pacifist or to be a nonviolent activist is to be a coward or is to be passive, right? And but this is the mistake, right, that pacifism doesn't mean passive, right? And in fact, Gandhi said this, is that you need a lot of courage to be a nonviolent activist. And so the idea is that nonviolence is a way of organizing people together to be able to put pressure and to coerce government to make changes towards hopefully a better social justice. But it does so using nonviolent means. That is, we never target to deliberately hurt people's lives, to harm them, to kill people. But the idea is that we organize people to get a message out there. How do we train people to give them the discipline to stand up for themselves, to have a sense that they have a role to play in making their society better? And so the idea of power is one in which you develop power as a group together to make changes. And so no individual person has power by themselves. They have something that we might call strength. An individual can be strong. But a community is something that has power. And it's a power of being able to trust on with one another, rely on one another, and to be able to come to an agreement about what needs to be changed in their lives so that their lives can be lived better. I think this is the kind of notion of power that Cesar Chavez is talking about. And the idea is that nonviolence is a tactic and a means by which to develop that power and to deploy it. So there's a lot of instances where he talks in military terms, right? He says that nonviolent activism is sort of like guerrilla warfare, but always he wants to emphasize that this is without the use of ever trying to deliberately hurt people or kill people, but it's to make to give voice in some sense to the powerless that are in our society by giving them power, by giving them voice, and moving things towards justice.
You draw a parallel between protest marches and pilgrimages in Mexican culture and people's ability and willingness to suffer for a greater goal.
Yeah, what I say in the book is that what I think that what's unique about Cesar Chavez was he was trying to develop a philosophy of nonviolence based on three principles or three values of nonviolence. And the first is this idea of pilgrimage. And the idea is here is that life should be seen as a journey towards greater justice, that we should see our lives as moving towards this kind of goal, and that this kind of goal should give orientation to the kinds of ways that we live our lives. So the idea is that we should see our lives as a pilgrimage towards the greater power of justice. And this is what he saw his life being devoted to. The second value is this idea of penitence. And this goes to the idea of the pilgrimages that you see in Mexico City, particularly around Easter. And also in New Mexico, where people will go to the Santuario de Chimayo. Right? The idea, this is a very deep and rich idea in Mexican culture and in Mexican Catholicism, the idea that it's important to suffer. And the suffering is not for the sake of any kind of masochism, but it's the idea that by suffering you gather strength and focus, and you gain a kind of vision that you need to be able to give yourself strength to move ahead towards that path towards justice. Right? And this is, this is an idea, this idea of penitence, of suffering, is very old in Mexican Catholicism, but you can trace it back even further into the Mesoamerican roots of the Aztecs and the Mayas, the idea that you sometimes need to bloodlet. And so there, in Mexican cultures, there's this rich emphasis that it infuses Cesar Chavez's work, this idea that through suffering, by learning how to suffer, we learn how to gain focus for the struggle for justice. And one of the important things about this idea of suffering is that Cesar Chavez believed that by suffering, we learn how to have empathy and sympathy for the suffering of others. If we know what suffering is, when we see others suffer, we can have a human bond with them. So one of the hunger strikes that he was most famous for in 1988 was in solidarity with the farm workers who suffer because of pesticides. And he refused food for over 20 days or so. And his statement at that time was, I do this suffering not because I'm trying to coerce people to do something. I'm doing this because I was ashamed. I wasn't aware of how much the farm workers were suffering because of pesticide, and I felt this kind of guilt. So I wanted to take their pain inside me. I wanted to show the world the kind of pain that the farm workers are suffering. And then after he finished his fast, he encouraged others to take on fasts. And so what he wanted to do was to create what he called a great chain of suffering, where for 3 days a person would take on a fast and to suffer after he had finished. Then another person would take on that chain. And the idea was to raise awareness of the kind of pain and suffering that farm workers go through because of exposure to various kinds of chemicals. And so this was a very a big theme throughout most of his activism and work, the idea that it is through suffering that we gain this kind of strength, this kind of discipline to understand what justice requires, but we also develop a certain kind of character that allows us to be able to feel the pain of others. And the final value about this is about revolution. Right? He believed that that what we need is great change in our social structures, in our economic structures, in our political structures, that will orient the world towards peace and nonviolence. And so, in one of his famous quotes, he says that in history, our institutions and our societies will be judged by how well they address the needs of the poor and the hungry. And so, for him, we needed a kind of revolution of values, a kind of different way of thinking about how our society should be structured. And, of course, he always again emphasized that this revolution must be done nonviolently. So for him, these values of pilgrimage, of a journey towards justice, of penitence, of learning to suffer for strength and for vision and for empathy, and revolution for a change in society, these were the kinds of values that really drove his life.
We're talking to Jose Antonio Orozco, author of Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence. In addition to things like hunger strikes, there were work strikes, boycotts, and many probably of our listeners were involved in boycotting grapes and so on. How well did these actually work in terms of creating conditions of better wages, better working conditions, political representation, and so on?
Well, they were tremendous in some sense. I think, you know, we have to understand that Cesar Chavez was not just a labor leader, and he was able to accomplish great reforms for workers and California, for instance, through the pressure of the United Farm Workers, California was able to pass legislation that gave the state the ability to recognize farm worker unions and created an agricultural board to oversee conditions in the fields. And so there was, you know, there was that kind of mobilization that he was able to accomplish within California. But we have to understand that the grape boycott of, that started in the late 60s was a worldwide phenomenon. I've talked to people who, you know, in talking about Cesar Chavez, people, you know, from New York, from the Netherlands, from Germany, who've told me, I was part of the boycott. I remember being part of this. I remember being in solidarity with the work. And so you have stories of people who remember the dock workers along the West Coast refusing, for instance, to load and unload grapes to go travel overseas. And so we have to understand this boycott, and this is the way that Cesar Chavez visioned it, was that by refusing to buy grapes, people who are too busy to become involved in protest marches or to become involved in strikes can have a part in trying to alleviate the suffering of others. So he was always about trying to develop various kinds of techniques that would give ordinary people the ability to express their solidarity with the suffering of others. And the boycott was a very, very effective way of doing that. Of course, there was the protests, the strikes, the marches. And in some sense, all of these things were part of the political strength. But he has this kind of cultural strength, too, as well. I think for many Mexican-Americans, for many Chicanos, and many of the listeners probably in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque and in New Mexico in general, were part of this the Chicano Movimiento of the 1960s and 70s, who saw Cesar Chavez as a figure who was finally saying, we, the ordinary people, the people of the earth, can have power, we can have voice, and we never have to go back again. And this is one of the things that he constantly, that Cesar Chavez constantly talked about, was that once you educate a person, once you give a person strength and the ability to stand up for themselves, you can't take that away from them. And so I think that there's this kind of cultural image that he has for Chicanos and Mexican Americans, this idea that we have the ability now to be able to stake our claims and to find a place in the United States.
How are farm workers in California doing now?
Well, it's a very difficult situation in many, many different places. There are laws in place, but shortly after, in the 1980s, shortly after there were the big reforms that Cesar Chavez's union started, conservative governors came in and started to dismantle many of these kinds of protections. And so it's a very difficult case. We can't generalize too much, but we can say that in some cases the lives of farm workers haven't improved all that much. In many cases, they are still paid piecemeal. In some farms, for instance, they receive inadequate housing, if any housing at all. In the late 1990s, there was a great exposés in San Diego where farm workers were found to be living in caves outside of San Diego in their cars. And so, you know, if you go to the field, in some cases, some of these farms will not have water for them out in the, you know, 100-plus heat, no bathroom facilities, very little worker protection. And so by a case-by-case basis, we can see that in many ways, many farm workers still are an exploited class, very, very vulnerable population. And this is one of the saddest things is that, for instance, where I live in Oregon, the agricultural industry is one of the largest sectors of the Oregonian economy. And significant portions of the workers there who pick the food are Latino and largely Mexican immigrants. And so these are the people that are picking our food, that are giving us the food that is on our plate each and every night. And these are the people that, from the standpoint of worker and work-safe workplace protection and safety, are the most exploited and vulnerable. And so, there are some laws in place in several states, but there's nothing federal. There's nothing nationwide, and so we see various kinds of cases of exploitation, like in California, in Florida, and so there's still quite a bit of work to be done in making sure that these people who provide so much for the rest of the United States are taken care of.
Jose Antonio Orozco is the author of the book Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence, published by the University of New Mexico Press, and he will be at Garcia Street Books tonight, Monday, the 14th of July, from 5 to 6 in the evening. Jose Antonio, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.